Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This episode I catch up with my old friend Gareth Saywell, head chef at RSA London's Notting Hill, to see how the UK hospitality industry has dealt with the effects of COVID-19. Guest today, Gareth Saywell, old friend from back in Wales. How are you, mate?
Good, how are you?
Yes, not too bad. Good to see you. Good to talk to you. It's been a while.
It's been a very long time. We haven't seen each other in person in about six, seven, eight years, maybe.
Last time I was home was 2017, but that was a very short visit. That was like a week before I opened Cavo, so I was there for like 9 days. I'm not sure if I even caught you. I had to like basically not contact most people when I was there because I was like, I gotta do some work and I've got like 9 days there to see family and some friends.
That's fine.
Yeah, but we sort of kept in touch, followed your career from Wales to London. Do you want to give us a little rundown of your story, your backstory, the story is
I went to university and studied economics, money, banking and finance. So we were talking earlier about head chefs sort of running into the problem of not being able to write a spreadsheet on Excel or whatever. So I actually do have quite a bit of experience with that at the beginning. But like you said earlier, being a misfit, you tend to generally sort of like fall out of that. And I've spoken to loads of chefs who have gone to university, left university for whatever reason. So I didn't complete my degree. I went back home and worked in a cafe, basically making paninis, and didn't know what to do with my life. And then somebody asked me, friend Katie Tanner, the Pollen, are looking for chefs. Do you want to join? So basically started there. So you worked in the Pollen as well. That's how we know each other.
That was just after I left, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think I could potentially have been your replacement, if I'm honest.
I think they did hire a couple of people. I think I didn't work out. I think you were rostered in very last minute. So I think maybe I came back and did a couple of weeks after I'd finished or something, just because
to fill the boots.
That was our week together in the kitchen, maybe.
Yeah, nice. As you know, it's a very steep learning curve in the Pollen. Great place to learn. Three chefs on a service. So first day on pastry, and then onwards.
Seven entrees.
It was a great place to learn. Like wonderful people, small kitchen, great food, and it was, let's call it, real cooking. So sort of learn how to cook. Protein, soups, bases, et cetera, et cetera. And then I went to, moved to London 3 years after that. So I wanted to cook Italian food and I wanted to work to move to London to work in a bigger restaurant, see what was going on. And I actually hated London as a place. When I'd visit throughout uni, and it was sort of like financial capital, blah, blah, blah. And I just saw it as a rat race. It was horrible. And then as soon as I started getting into food, I'd visit London or friends in London, and I was sort of like seeing all these restaurants, seeing the possibilities, you know, possibilities of me actually being able to eat and live in this place. And all of a sudden I loved it. So moved there, and then I worked in a restaurant called Bocca di Lupo, which is a regional Italian restaurant. And I worked there for 4 years.
It's one of those restaurants that obviously it wouldn't be that well known outside the UK, but it's a bit of a London institution pretty legendary across the UK.
Yeah, I think it's been open for more than 10 years, let's say 12, 13 years. But it's one of those places that they do the simple things, but they do it right. They make their own bread. Again, learning curve there was fairly steep. Learning charcuterie, making salamis, making andouille, making sausages, and you know you're making 50 kilos of sausages. One day I made 100 kilos of sausages in one go. So the learning curve is very steep there again, but super rewarding. And obviously, like staying in a restaurant for 4 years, that's quite a long stretch in terms of London careers, I guess.
Yeah.
But I.
Why did you stay so long? Was that planned, or was it just you kept learning, or you're enjoying it, or the situation was right?
I kept on learning. So I kept on learning every opportunity. I was, even any time I'd consider, right, okay, let's learn something new, let's go to another restaurant, I'd classic be given more responsibility, get a promotion, discuss this with them, and then all of a sudden you have more things on your plate to learn. I think that as soon as the cooking side of it sort of like slowed down in terms of learning, I was fairly competent with sausages and charcuterie and sort of running service, etc. Then came the management side of it, sort of like learning how to deal with a brigade. And there was, let's say, a brigade of 15 to 20. And learning to deal with people and people's different needs, people's different sort of like problems, etc. Or sort of just running a day-to-day restaurant, doing the basics in terms of menus, not in terms of input, but you know, changing menus, dealing with problems, dealing with allergens, dealing with the things behind closed doors that you don't really consider when you're a CDP and you're cooking and you're enjoying, you're in the shit, you change and you go home. But then there's that sort of like behind closed doors thing of allergens.
These things are kind of, as you move up the ranks, you realize that these things are as important, if not more important, than whether, like, you know, how well you can cook, like people management. It's all good, like, to be able to write some insane tasting menu 20 dishes long, but if you can't actually get your team to do it by teaching them, keeping them happy and consistent, then you've just wasted all your time. So it's something that, yeah, you're trying to get across to young chefs. And probably someone along the way said to us, we probably didn't listen. So I mean, it's great to get the opportunity to do that and to see that in a business.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that obviously in terms of management styles as well, I think I was told when I was sort of like promoted to sous role, basically forget about, you're too friendly with people, you're too nice, or not too, you're too friendly, you need to sort of like step back from being friends with people and start sort of like being a boss. So that's sort of, that was quite difficult to take at that point. But I think what I did was I sort of like started becoming some kind of like robot. And I started to sort of like work it in the way that other people would want me to work it. And then I became quite unhappy, and I realized that you can have your own management style without without being that person. So you can be friends with people, but when you want things done, if you click your fingers, things need to happen. So I became more comfortable with my own management style, and basically just being fucking nice to people, trying my best to be nice to people.
Yeah,
enjoying you're in the kitchen for such a long time, and high pressure, everything's hot. It's nice to be nice, and I love what I do, and I love cooking, and it's nice to sort of to see that in other people as well, rather than people never need to be worried in work about what Gareth is going to say, or sort of as long as they're having a good time and they're doing things to a standard, to an exceptional standard, and everything is the best. But at the end of the day, if they're not happy, then there's no point.
It's something that's kind of point I make as well, is that especially when you owner or head chef or exec chef, you spend so much time in that environment, like you live and breathe it. Why would you actively make that environment a shit place to be?
Yeah, like for yourself as well.
Just seen chefs where it's like you can tell they don't like being there half the time, and you're like, this is your business, like, but you're the one making it shit. So like it's a tough thing to do. I think it's probably tougher when you've moved up through the ranks and you've been at like similar level to people, and you've got to tell them what to do and how to do it. And that can be tough for sure. But I definitely think that old guard mentality of you can't be friends with everyone. There's you're probably not going to be like, buddy, having drinks with them every single night, but you can be nice. You can be friends. You can have a relationship outside work. And as long as there's respect there, you can still ask people to do something and you can tell them they need to do it better. And hold people accountable. I think as long as everyone buys in, but I think people are much more willing to buy in if they like you, and rather than just doing it from fear.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that if you, like you say, rising through the ranks in a restaurant, and you see how other people have been treated, or how you sort of like you go by example of, right, okay, that's how a sous chef is supposed to act, or that's how you should be, and then I realized fairly early on within weeks that I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to do it my way and see if it worked. I was there for 4 years in total, just over 4 years. Left there as senior sous. I'd had enough by then. So I'd seen it all, and I'd done everything, and I had enough of that restaurant. But it was a great experience, and like I said, things that have sort of stayed with me, obviously making pasta, making everything from I think it instilled more in me as well. So like make everything yourself, make everything from scratch, do the simple things right, and then work from there, and you can make things as elaborate or fancy as you want then. Working on some fish sausages and fish charcuterie and stuff now, just as a project for myself. Yeah. Something from obviously all those skills come from making 150 kilos of sausage.
That would make you a good sausage maker.
towards the end, you're right. But then after that, I sort of had a few, I think I didn't have anything planned. I just sort of left at the end of Christmas, did sort of like stayed like I am the diligent person, sort of like right until the end. And then I took a couple of months, I think. So I think I was off for about 3 months. I literally sort of like, don't want to say recovering, but sort of like giving my brain a rest, sort of like slowing things down, being what I wanted to do. And my now wife Mary was sort of looking at me, and she could see that I was sort of itching to get back into a kitchen. I didn't know that, but she knew that.
Banging pans and shouting around the kitchen.
Yeah.
calling lunch away to your wife.
Fuck you. So yeah, she suggested that I did a few stages. So I did a few stages in St. John's.
Awesome.
Went to St. Leonard's, which was open at the time, which Jackson Boxer, who is the owner of the restaurant I'm currently in, sort of had a hand in. I just went around and an opportunity to see how other kitchens worked. I'd worked in, by that point, I would consider myself a very experienced chef. I'd worked in two restaurants, one in Wales, one in Ireland, one in London. And that was it. That was my sole experience of kitchens. So it was nice to see St. John, how obviously it's an iconic, it's an institution, how they worked, and yeah, just to see how other kitchens worked in London. And that was very important for me to see before I sort of like moved on, I think. And then there was a new opening advertised, so called Orose. We opened it 2.5 years ago, and I've been here ever since. So we started in a, let's say, a sous role, let's say, overseeing it, and then soon became head chef. And I've been here since that. So Orose is a, let's say, a restaurant focused on seafood, British seafood, and then influences from here, there, everywhere. It's
It looks awesome. Like, it looks like the place you want to eat, in the best possible way. Looks like it's that kind of food that I think Australia doesn't do particularly well. We don't have too many of it, and it's food I miss. Is that sort of neighborhood, high end casual, excellent ingredients, simplicity done well with that kind of European influence, which is just a delight to actually eat and experience.
Yeah, and I think it's good food for chefs to cook as well, or sort of like keeps you interested. And like I said, we make our own bread in the morning, so we come in, we make our own bread, we make everything from scratch. Everything is made in house. Where reasonable, basically. And it's been a very successful roller coaster, obviously, with being open, closed, here, there, everywhere. But it's been a great ride, and it's, although however difficult it gets, obviously now we're in a very difficult period, well, in London and everywhere, but however difficult it gets, it's always a pleasure to walk through the door, put your apron on, and get cracking.
Still on. You haven't even taken off for this.
Today's my day off, but we've actually closed on Tuesdays now due to staffing. But the fish comes in on Tuesday, so it's an opportunity for me to crack on with some fish prep and then ease the pressure for tomorrow, basically.
So opened up in 2019 or 18?
2019, February 2019.
So the year that no restaurant owner should have, or no restaurateur should have opened a restaurant. That's pretty, pretty amazing timing. So tell us a little bit about when, a little bit about the, I guess it was about the same time you guys closed down, around March 2020. Describe what the sort of, because I mean, I was in Wollongong and we were all the sort of restaurant owners, we had a little group chat and we were trying to work out what's going on, and everyone was predicting like, I'm gonna get locked down, this, that, the other. I think UK may have gone a little bit beforehand, and that was quite shocking to me. And then we followed. Give us a little idea of what kind of London felt like at that time with everything starting to happen.
I think it was, for me, or the feeling that I got is that everyone felt quite positive. And sort of like, let's say early March, everyone was, nah, it's not going to happen. It's not going to, we're not in
the flu.
Yeah, everything's fine. Obviously, everyone was very diligent with sort of hygiene, etc. But it was something that you felt as if wasn't going to affect you. And then as time rolled on, you thought, oh, this is a bit serious.
Yeah.
And then it came overnight, essentially, sort of like immediate lockdown. So we had one surreal day of, or evening, let's say, at the end of shift of sort of like fermenting everything, pickling everything.
Yeah. Then Noma fermentation book out that night.
Yeah, definitely. It's 3%. Cool. Just go with 3%. Chef, what do you want?
Yeah. It's the whole book of 3%, isn't it?
Yeah, just do it 3%.
Don't buy it. Just remember, it's always 3%. It's always 3% for salt.
Yeah, absolutely. 2% for something that you want a little bit faster. And you're good. Yeah.
That's it.
If I knew at the time how long we'd be in, I would have gone 5%. But I think it was. I don't think everyone sort of like understood that it was going to last that long. We were sort of like pickling things and processing things to be closed for a period of time. Mm-hmm. We thought it was a couple of weeks, sort of like rolling on to a month. But the most difficult part of it was that there wasn't a time frame. So we were rolling in sort of like 1 week to the next, sort of like, oh, it's still going on. And you know, I started off looking at the news every day and reading it, and it sort of like progressively got worse and worse and worse. So I'd sort of like limited my news reading to sort of like once a day. Otherwise, you start to overthink things, or you know, especially a year ago, it was more of the unknown. It was unprecedented. Nobody knew what the fuck was going on. So I just kept myself busy, and you know, we were sort of like at home. I was reading books. I was sort of like slowly, piquing my interest. And like I said, with sort of like being out of the kitchen, you sort of like, you start to get twitchy. Yeah. So I was just ordering. Then I ordered I'm not going to say half a pig, but I ordered a fair amount of pig. I got a pig's head in, and I just had my little projects. And I think at the time, London was in complete lockdown. There was ghost town. Yeah. If you imagine riding your bike through London and seeing, you know, two people.
Yeah.
That's unheard of. Yeah. And there was like literally nothing going on whatsoever. There was no light at the end of the tunnel. Nobody knew when things were opening up. So I think behind closed doors then, you have, let's say, discussions with sort of like business owners, speaking to landlords, you know, what can we do in this situation? Mm-hmm. We were very lucky in terms of landlords sort of like being very, very reasonable. Otherwise, you, as a business, you can't cope, can you? Like you, you know better than me. You have X amount of overheads, whether the restaurant is open or closed.
Yeah.
So you've got like money coming out, no money coming in. Mm-hmm. How can you cope with that? And how many restaurants?
And anti how you do business, basically. Like If more money's going out and you have nothing coming in, that's not a good way to do it. And restaurants have very tight margins, and there's never too much saved not many people had a pandemic fund going. I know we didn't. Yeah. Wasn't something really our accountant ever warned us of, bastard? I wish he had, just in case. Did you guys just close? Did you stay open? Were you doing takeaway? Were you doing home kits? Did people in London change that straight away, or did that take a little bit of time? Or what was the pivot move?
I think so. We basically closed. Every member of staff was furloughed.
Yeah.
And then So my boss or the owner, Jackson, he started takeaway, basically started to do this takeaway service, which was, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think it was sort of like one of the first in London. And then all of a sudden he was getting phone calls from everyone asking how to do it. I was at home furloughed and he did it with...
If you were on the furlough scheme, you weren't expected to work at all? You were just...
It's flexible in terms of... So they call it furlough, you get 80% of your wage, let's say. Yeah. So the way the restaurants work around here in terms of... what your wage is and what your overall income is made up out of service charge. So your actual wage is essentially minimum wage, whether you're the KP or the head chef. Mm-hmm. So 80% of your wage is actually what the government pay you is.
There's a disparity with what people were getting paid and what they would...
And
actually normally get paid with London's famous 12.5%. Is it still 12.5% standard?
Yeah, it is.
I haven't quite got that in Australia yet. Like I'm as a diner, I'm glad. As an owner, I'm like, that'd be nice if I could charge everyone an extra 12.5%.
Do you charge more for food then?
Well, we've got some of the highest minimum wage in the world. So for example, a qualified chef of sort of middling ability would be on about $26 an hour. So it's about £13. Obviously the standard, living cost is higher here. But on the flip side, it's really cheap to eat in Australia. Yeah. Like eating out at like a three hat restaurant or 2-1 hat restaurant is so much cheaper than the UK. So we pay really high wages and we charge fuck all for our food, which means raise the fucking slim margins at times. So people are paid pretty well. And people do tip, but it's not massive. So we don't need that service charge to, I mean, it'd be nice if we could just pocket it, but we don't need that to supplement wages, as it were.
Yeah, right.
It's probably the main
thing. Living costs, obviously London rent is very high. We basically have just enough money to pay your rent and then that's it. It came at a good time for me to just sort of like relax and slow down, and it was terrible, but it came at the perfect time for me to just sort of like slow down, and I did quite well out of it. I became healthy, and we were eating very well and we were exercising, and it was good for the brain to keep occupied. The restaurant was running or working with people who missed out on furlough. So basically Jackson ripped out people who couldn't get furloughed, which is very kind. And people just came in from here, there, everywhere and started working.
That's awesome.
Which was great. And it was, good for them, good for the restaurant. But you can't, in terms of a business model, you can't run a takeaway service the same as you would in terms of sort of like restaurant. You can't, in terms of GP, you're not going for sort of like 70% or whatever what you're aiming is to, I guess, bring money in, some money, whatever it may be, just to cover sort of like outgoings.
Get close to your rent. That's about all a lot of people manage to do right now. That was all you were really asking for.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you do?
So Cavo, the fine dining restaurant, we closed, which we ended up closing permanently. The wine bar Night Parrot, which we had already thought about doing, potentially doing like Deliveroo and Uber Eats with, And that's, you know, very simple dumplings, bao's, white boy Asian food. So we were able to pivot that very easily to do takeaway. After about a week or so of getting together, we had some ideas for Kavo, but we weren't particularly confident, and it was easier to shut that up, bring our staff over to do takeaway delivery, which was a bit of a change. Like, neither of us had really worked in the bar that much. I'd done a couple of bits in the kitchen here and there, but it was very much our side gig. So I mean, the first night we did takeaway, we weren't quite set up with Uber Eats yet. So we're like, oh, we'll just do. So Tom, my business partner, and I were like, we'll do it. So we'll put up on social media, call us, send us a message, Facebook, Instagram, fucking whatever it is, LinkedIn, send us a message, give us your address. We'll bring our FBOS machines. I was like, all right, I'll cook, you drive, sorted. And we just got fucking slammed. Like, one of the hardest services. So like, Tom's trying to like pack stuff, and like, we just weren't ready of like, you know, everyone at 7 o'clock wants to order, and people like, all our regulars were trying to help, and we're ordering like shit tons of food, like more food than they could eat, more food than they normally order, and it's all coming in an hour. So we had to rope Tom's dad in to come and drive a bit. Like, his sister ended up rocking up to like pack some orders. I was just slammed in the kitchen. I was like, fucking hell. So that was a nice little run after a week of sitting at home doing fuck all. So we did that. Like, I mean, that kind of leveled off a bit. Weekdays were quiet, so you'd just be one of us. So like a week, like a Tuesday night would involve one of us going in, turning the steamer on, turn the fryers on, and probably watching a film, and then pausing it to do three or four orders. And it was very much, the government here allowed us to sell takeaway booze. So we were doing some cocktails. If anything, it was pretty nice to get out of the house. Like, we're on sort of a main strip there with lots of friends in bars. Some of the boys did a little like bottle shop in their bar. So other people were doing takeaway. So everyone was kind of being able to say hello to everyone and keep in touch and support each other. So we just turned into a dumpling takeaway dumpling shop. Natty wine shop.
Yeah, nice. I think that, I mean, it's I guess that was quite nice. Obviously, it occupies your mind, but quite nice to sort of like slow down and cook something fun. Do you think? Or
No, I hated it because we were pretty sure we were going to close Kavo, so that was pretty tough for me. It was great that a lot of chefs enjoyed it and were like, I haven't had this much time off, like, great to relax, great to do some exercise, great to cook at home. I hated all of you at the time because I was like, no, this is fucking terrible. What do you mean this is a good thing? This is not a benefit. So I'm glad everyone enjoyed it. I can see the funny side of it now, but at the time I was not very happy. Another story.
Sorry, you go on.
It was interesting to see everyone change, and some people did some awesome stuff. Like, people were doing, you know, cook at home things with instructions. I know there's some guys in Melbourne were doing, like, people would buy a produce box and then they would film all the recipes and they could cook them over the week. So it was pretty impressive to see the hospitality industry, probably more so than any other industry, move with and roll with the punches and get stuff done. I know some people who did, like, my friend has a little bar, and COVID, and it's in the sort of suburb of Wollongong, a little bit off the track, and COVID lockdown made them, like, suddenly everyone was ordering burgers from them and they became famous for their burgers in the area. And like, speaking of them, they're like, it was probably the best thing that happened to us.
I mean, it is amazing to see that, but a lot of people, like you say, it has made a lot of people, and they've benefited from COVID, which is, if you can do that, you've been very lucky. To have been affected positively by it is not something that you'd expect, but good.
Yeah, exactly. So how long were you guys in that original lockdown for?
So we came back, so let's say end of March until early June, I believe it was. I think it was the 2nd, 3rd of June. So we didn't know we were coming back until I think 2 or 3 weeks there was sort of like the mentioned date. So yeah, it's quite a long time of the unknown. And yeah. We were sat at home, you know, catching up on, I'd never watched Harry Potter, and all of a sudden watching Harry Potter, watched, you know, Star Wars in chronological order, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, nice.
Basically, it was time.
Important things.
Yeah, I mean, I caught up on sort of like on life, basically.
Yeah.
Still haven't watched Breaking Bad, but
it's a slog, but it's good. It's probably worth it. Next lockdown, just save it for next lockdown. Next pandemic.
I mean, you've got your pocket, like, it's a long slog, but if there ever was a time,
you know, you're ready now, so that's good.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully I've missed my opportunity, but yeah, it was time to go back. And then as soon as we were back, it was all guns blazing. Everyone was sort of like itching to get back into the kitchen. And we went fairly hard, and it was brilliant. We were understaffed. So it was long and hard at the same time. And it was literally from 0 to 100 in sort of like the first week. So it was,
Was it significantly busier? I imagine London always pretty consistent with being busy, but was there a surge of people wanting to dine out?
I think initially it was, people took it a little bit easy. I think everyone was happy that restaurants were back, yet skeptical of COVID. So
yeah,
we sort of like eased into it. And then all of a sudden, as soon as people felt comfortable, it skyrocketed and it was insane. And, you know, you were full every dinner service, every lunch service. It was go, go, go. And we were also running takeaway sandwiches at the same time, which became popular over lockdown. So not only were we running a full-time restaurant, we were also doing a takeaway gig.
That panini making from Carmarthen came in handy.
Yeah, I mean, I was prepared. I didn't know what it was for, but it was for this. So for that, and I'll be forever grateful. but yeah, it was cool. It was great to be back in the kitchen. But I mean, everyone was, you know, there was lots of what ifs and sort of like plans for this, that, and the other. But I think that people were unrealistic in thinking that we weren't going to go into another lockdown. We just basically sort of like, right, whilst, well, us personally, we sort of like went in hard and we were like, right, okay, things are probably going to go worse before they get better. So let's make hay whilst the sun shines, basically. So we just sort of like try to hit it as hard as possible, but being realistic and thinking that this isn't over by a long shot and things are probably gonna go awry again, which inevitably they did.
But you had sort of, you almost planned for that and expected to happen?
I mean, we didn't plan for it,
yeah,
per se. we expected it and we knew it was coming, but we hadn't sort of like properly planned for it. I think within sort of like a week of knowing that we were going to be locked down again, we did exactly the same, processed everything, run everything down. And then learning from the first lockdown, so I think they offered like quite a big menu and there was sort of like full meals and it was like a finish at home kit, sort of like put this in the oven and sort of like warm this up, temper this, blah, 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 done. And that was very good. But like I said, sort of not sustainable and not sort of like, you couldn't sort of like run the business like that. So the second lockdown, they decided to only offer sandwiches. So like you said, Panini boy from Carmarthen came back. And that was great for us as chefs to basically just to occupy our brains and have some kind of structure for the day. We made all our buns, we made everything fresh every day. We made sort of like every single item, and it was it was good for us to have an opportunity to make some filthy sandwiches with all of our own, you know, we were making our own bread and butter pickles and making potato rolls and making this, that, and the other. And is some, you know, most of it was unnecessary, but it purely, yeah, yeah. It was more for us than for the customers.
Like it's still cooking, but without the sort of pressure and a bit of fun to put together, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, we were making delicious food, but like you say, is pressure more, well, less pressure, sort of like enjoyable to an extent, but it was purely for us more than anything in terms of being sustainable as sort of like a business model. Is, you know, restaurants can't sort of like all overnight turn into a sandwich shop, and you can't compete with places that sort of like purely run on, let's say, economies of scale. They just go, and the volume, you can't compete with volume. And like you said, like, you know, you had nights where we were prepping things ready for the next day, and we were making pickles, and upstairs we had a ping pong table, and we were, you know, as soon as everything was done, we were taking it easy or bringing a book in or that sort of thing. And then some days you'd be going down on 5 chicken sandwiches and sort of like, and you were like, what's happening?
It's a little bit humbling when you are like, I'm trying to steam dumplings for 3 tickets, and I feel like I'm in the shit.
Yeah,
fucking hell.
I've got a fries drop. I haven't got space.
I mean, if anything, it highlights how important being set up is, because like at any level, like even if you're doing sandwiches, if you're like, mise isn't done, you will go down on sandwich section real fucking hard.
Where's the shredders? Oh shit. there was a lot of that, if I'm honest, but we had a great time, but it wasn't sustainable. I can't remember how long that was for.
That seemed like, from a viewing from over here, and obviously I still keep an eye and keep in touch with people back home, that seemed like it was quite long. Like it was longer than the first time, it seemed.
I think
it might have been, like you said, that thing of like, you start off by looking at the news like every day, and then you kind of realize you're in for a long run and you stop kind of checking. So it could have been that.
I think it was, I feel as if it was shorter than the first one, but I think because we had some kind of date in mind. So you kind of like knew when it was like coming, and it was fine, but it wasn't the best of times in terms of
what was the feeling around. So obviously we've just gone in, I mean, for New South Wales, we're a month into our second lockdown, which I really think people didn't see coming here. We've had low deaths, like, I mean, only has gone over 100 deaths or so, less than 10,000 cases. So we've been pretty safe here. So everyone hasn't had that much to worry about. And then on the flip side, when there is a couple of cases, especially with the Delta variant, we've been very quick to get into lockdown to stop it spiraling out of control. But I don't think that people were not prepared, in New South Wales especially, for another lockdown. So I think it's taken a lot of people by surprise, and it's a pretty tight one. And it definitely feels that everyone's a little bit more on edge. I think last time everyone was a little bit like, oh, this is different, like time off work and, you know, a bit of this, bit of that, and this one, everyone's like, oh fuck. So what was the general feeling around town with the second lockdown?
So I think it was sort of like opposite here. So the first one was shit. It was sort of like the tightest. You know, like I said, the streets in London were empty. There was nobody there. You could ride a bike through London. There weren't cars anywhere. Literally, it was lockdown. The second time, it felt sort of like a little bit busier. People were sort of like, I think you were allowed to go to shops, or you were allowed to, basically you could roam slightly freer than the first one. And I think that people were over it before it had already begun, basically. So I think, which I possibly would contributed to us going into third lockdown, maybe. But people were very, very chill. There were a lot less people around on the streets. People were like dealing as if it was, well, this is life now. This is us. So like, we've got to carry on and do something. Yeah. And people seem to, people weren't congregating or sort of like having, I'm sure some people were having parties and stuff, but it wasn't wild. But there were sort of like many instances on, let's say the restaurant is on not in Notting Hill, so just off Portobello Road, and without fail, people were sort of like gathering on the streets on sort of like a Friday night to have beers together, and there were lots of sort of like police vans around everywhere, sort of like containing it rather than just people sort of like following the rules, etc. It was a weird vibe. People sort of like knew that there was something weird going on, but there was certainly a split between the people that cared about it and people that sort of like thought, let's just carry on with life. It was weird, if I'm honest.
It's definitely, I think the anti-vax COVID denier people are out in force a lot more in this second lockdown. We had a massive rally in Sydney recently with, there was like 5,000 of them fucking wandering around maskless. So I think, I think that's a little bit of a difference now here, is it's, I think, people are a bit more frustrated. They felt a bit more like we were all in this together, although I sort of hate that term, especially when rich celebrities use it and you're like, well, you're in your mansion and these guys are in a block of flats. Not quite the same, but I think there's just a bit of frustration and kind of, and almost like a bit of blaming of like, well, if everyone would have been as diligent as hospitality in particular, we wouldn't be in this mess again. So I think there's a bit of tension kind of boiling over now at this point with it gone on for so long. So it's kind of it's you kind of get a vibe of what everyone's kind of feeling at a certain time. It's quite strange. So coming out of that one, straight back into it again, and another open up, another pounding, or
heavy pounding. that was leading up to I think we were open for a month after that. It was a very short one, but it was sort of like leading up to Christmas. And it was we expected to be closed over Christmas time. We felt as if that was going to be sort of like another lockdown, but we were again sort of closed early. So I think we closed on the 20th of December or something like that. It was short, but painful. It was good to cook, let's call it real food again. But nobody was under any sort of like misconception that it wasn't gonna go bad again. I think.
Yeah. Like people don't realize is how it's not like you just, if you've been closed for a little while in a restaurant, it's not like you just rock up one day and you cook all the food and then you serve it at night. It's such an effort to reopen or open a restaurant. We used to do it like twice a year at Cavo when we'd close for a couple of weeks for holidays and things. And to the point where we sort of stopped doing it when Tom and I owned the business, because for everyone else, it'd be 2 weeks off. For us, it'd be like 2-3 days after we closed, packing it down. And then it'd also be some stuff we wanted to get done. And then it'd be a couple of days before we opened back up. And we're like, I think I had 3 days off in a 2 week holiday. Like it's so much work to get all those things. Like it's not a 1 day job.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, knowing how restaurants work, obviously you understand what sort of what needs to be done behind closed doors. I think people generally don't have zero idea of what goes on in restaurants. They they don't understand the entire thing. What they want to do is turn up, eat food, pay as little as possible for it, have a great time, and go home. Well, they don't understand the sort of like the entire economics behind it, and sort of like the work that goes on behind closed doors, and even down to cleaning. Or there's bodies everywhere, and there's you know, to prepare and to get a restaurant ready to serve customers is masses of work. And I don't think there's an understanding in general of what goes into that. We had a heavy month, and then we closed straight away again. So that was the toughest one for us. It was over Christmas, and obviously it was nice to have Christmas off. I think by that time as well, people were completely over it. And although there was a lockdown, it was literally a split of, you know, people following the rules and people not. So there was no sort of like togetherness and all that stuff. And there was, as you mentioned, sort of like people starting to voice opinions. This is what I would have done. Everyone's expert in how to deal with the world pandemic. Obviously, hindsight is a beautiful thing. And as soon as vaccines starting to get rolled out, I think that was the most exciting part of the last year. To not to, you know, it's, you can sort of like dream that it's the beginning of the end, if that makes sense.
It was the only long-term answer, really. It was treading water until that moment. So
actually,
so that's pretty amazing. So and then after that last one, was it May the reopen?
We open. So we did outdoor dining. So
right, yeah.
We've got, let's say, two car park spots outside the restaurant.
Where the chefs normally sit.
Yeah. So we don't have outdoor dining, basically. Mm-hmm. Or we didn't. Now we do. So the council has decided to, or many boroughs have decided to, basically pedestrianize as many streets as possible, which is brilliant. I mean, you see Soho, for instance, now it's just, there's not a car in sight. It's just sort of like masses of people. Good that in the middle of a pandemic is sort of like neither here nor there, but they pedestrianize the streets outside. So we had two parking bays. So basically built a semi-permanent structure, provided that you can basically get rid of it at, so the initial date was September this year that we had to get rid. They've, in hindsight, extended that to initially December, and then now until, I think, September next year. So it's like forever a growing thing. But we'd never done a tasting menu. But we opened up doing purely for, I think, to ensure spend per head, to ensure that there was actual sort of like food, a minimum food spend. And I think, I can't remember the exact of it, but I think we had maybe 40 capacity, or I think sort of like mid-30s in terms of turns, etc. But it was a very small operation at the same time. So we had four tables of six out there that could potentially be, you know, a four, a two, whatever. And then two other tables outside, and that was it. And we basically run a short tasting menu, purely fish. So we were getting everything from day boats, from Cornwall. And we were sort of like basically supporting fishermen that were, well, they've had a tough time, obviously, with restaurants being closed. Everyone down, I think that's what we've seen is everyone down the chain has been affected by it. Like from chef to KP to waitress to manager to blah, 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 all the way down the line through your supply chain. Which obviously it was nice to support like fishermen and the guys that were working in Cornwall. So we got fish in every day and run a 5-6 course menu. And that was until, I think that we did that for four or five weeks. And then indoor dining opened up again in mid-May or late May. And all of a sudden, from going to we restricted our table sizes indoors, you know, for between the first and the third lockdown. So from going from a, let's say, 50 capacity restaurant, all of a sudden, when we opened up again, we had the we had possibility to do, we were doing sort of like 80, and we still are doing sort of like 80 plus. And all of a sudden, the restaurant has changed. It's become more of a beat.
Designed for 40, 50 that you're trying to do for 80 then.
And then in our storage, let's say, so that we don't have a walk-in or whatever. So I run a fairly tight ship, let's say, and try to minimize as many sort of things as possible. And, you know, basically got pretty good at guessing how many of this we're going to sell. All of a sudden, double capacity, you don't have the room for anything. And you're sort of like, you're firing on all cylinders with less chefs, et cetera. And that's where those problems would sort of like start to creep in of staffing in general. What's the vibe in Australia in terms of chefs?
It's been interesting to see how UK has hit the same snag as we have. Staffing is the number one topic and issue right now. With being quite low cases, everyone was rare. So as soon as we opened back up, everyone was raring to go. Like, everyone was getting slammed. Everyone was just full every day, especially regional. Regional recovered quicker than the city because everyone wanted to get out of the city. A lot of people were working remotely, so they were spending their time and money in the regional areas. So Wollongong, where I am, was just packed. It was huge. The bar we were capped to one per 4 square meters. So we could do 20 people in the bar for months, and we were doing and so we ended up doing sittings, whereas normally it was, you know, in and out whenever we started doing like booked sittings, and we were full for them, and we were doing more money than we'd do with a full bar normally. Like it was turning. So, and everyone was the same. So then the problem became, especially in regional, everyone wanted to open up extra lunches, extra dinner, extra day, because they've got the customers for it, but no one has the staff. And there is so many job vacancies around. On the bright side, wages have been, as a baseline, Australia been good, but as you moved up, it didn't really ever get much better. So one of the benefits is, I think what's on offer for chefs now is much better. Wages are higher, hours are down. Everyone's finally, very desperate to find good chefs. So the market's quite good there. But it's the one issue whenever I talk to anyone across the country right now, is staffing's the problem. And that's a lot of it because we sent all the immigrants home. Like I was pretty close to having to go home at one point. Some really short-sighted decisions on that. And then I think a lot of people in hospitality were just sick of it. Like, just, you know, knowing that another lockdown would mean they would lose their job, with casual and, you know, gig economy workers. That was too tough for a lot of people to take. And it's probably a long time coming. So I think, although it's an issue, I think it can have some benefits going forward. So I imagine you're going to find that as well, is that to keep people and to get people to stay in the industry, it's going to have to pay them.
Yeah, surprising that, isn't it?
Shocker.
I think people have, so in London and the UK, obviously before anything or Corona, etc., we had the wonderful Brexit. So
yeah.
all of the skilled workers and European guys were, you know, great chefs, whatever. They were just like, well, fuck this, let's go somewhere where we'll get appreciated. And yeah, a lot of sort of like chef friends from various countries that I know have gone either home or basically to another country.
Imagine front of house in London, because I mean you'd hardly see a British front of house manager in London half the time. And who wants to be served by a British person front of house? No one, honestly. Like, put a French accent on if you are. Like, it's much more charming.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's, I mean, few and far in between, really. There's sort of like everywhere is just sort of like full of, well, I say full of British people. There's sort of like some guys have stayed, but it's the entire market, back of house and front of house, is just saturated, and there's, you know, there's problems all across the board with staffing.
Yeah.
And not only staffing, but sort of like the right person for the job. I feel as if, I mean, places are sort of like more, I mean, getting to the point where welcoming of anyone that walks through the door. And if somebody walks through the door, they're likely to get a job, whether they can do it or not. And then sort of like there's a training period then where you're sort of like going through and sort of like seeing, basically giving people a chance and whether they can do it or not. But there's, like you say, there's, I think chefs have sort of like sat down, had a bit of time off, read some books, or sort of like had some time to do another hobby, and some of them have decided, fuck this, like, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
Why am I busting my gut for somebody else? Sure, I enjoy it, but there's more to life than to be in within those. Yeah. So I mean all of the benefits, they've just had a taste of it and thought, you know what, I like my partner, I want to spend more time with her or him.
Mm.
And they've had a taste of it, and it's not the worst thing in the world, especially for them.
I think it's going to take a bit of time for people to come back. I think obviously the industry is going to have to change with wages, with hours, with work-life balance, whatever that is. I've heard people say that. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Don't know what that is.
Yeah, never heard of that. He's speaking French. but I think, yeah, it's things are going to have to address. And I think eventually then people will see the industry as a viable one again, and hopefully it'll be better for it. I think that it's going to be a watering down of talent. I think you're going to have people who aren't ready for a head chef role be offered a lot of money for a head chef role, and they're going to take it. And I think we're going to see a sort of drop in overall quality of food, probably across all levels, which is you know, going to be sort of disappointing to see. And you hope that the sort of customers do understand some of what's going on. They seem to be very sympathetic to start with, but you've definitely seen the sort of Karens roll back in, and the complaints that you probably wouldn't have seen in the first lockdown here. Everyone was being very, very nice. They're starting to come back in, which is quite interesting. Yeah. I was going to touch on one thing for my listeners here.
Yeah.
People would not believe how few restaurants in the UK have a walk-in call room.
Yeah.
Like, everyone has them here because everything's built. Like, the UK, like, hardly anyone has a walk-in. Like, it's literally just fridges, like shitty white fridges. Like,
I mean, if you've got a walk-in, you're lucky. So obviously, London, in terms of real estate, it's all about space, space, space. And this, so the current restaurant or the restaurant I'm in now, I mean, there's nowhere to put it. where would you have a walk-in? So yeah, we've got two stand-up fridges, service fridges, and a big freezer. We don't even have space for a service freezer. So let's say when we're sort of like, we've got a packagette in the corner and we'll sort of like spin an ice cream and then put it back into a minus 20 freezer. And in 5 minutes, you're spinning another one. There's, I mean, basically there's, it's fine. It's workable with, you can, you work around it, you order less, you prep more every day, but that's the whole thing, is you sort of like, you do everything every day rather than get it boxed for the week or whatever. So that, that's the way I like to work.
Yeah. I mean, I just think some people in Australia haven't worked like that, and it shows, it shows.
Yeah.
That's not a bad way to work. We'll sort of wrap it up. Do you think there's anything, like you said, that you know, you changed to doing a tasting menu? I know people here have done the same thing, and it's sort of something they wanted to do, but were never quite confident. Even things like, you know, taking payments for bookings is becoming a lot more common. I think there's some positives that have come out. Is there anything specific that you think you've changed and you will keep going forward with RSA?
I think there's, well, like you say, cancellation fees, the feeling comfortable to charge a customer that, you know, doesn't rock up for their sort of like 7 p.m. Table for six people. I think the attitude towards that has changed in terms of sort of like feeling comfortable to make them pay for it rather than us pay for it. Hopefully you'll fill that table with a walk-in, etc. It's not always the case. I think we're more, I think it gives you a quiet confidence in what you're doing, and you're sort of like happier in serving your own food as to what you think that people want to eat. You cook what you want to cook, and hopefully they'll dig that. And we've gone back to a la carte now, after sort of like opening back to sort of like a full restaurant. But I think it's just nice to experience different things. And I think I feel quietly positive about the future, but very, very quietly. I'm not fully confident yet, but we'll see how it goes. But I think first moves for us and for many restaurants is to get staff, and then, like you say, staffing will take time, and that's going to be a case of, like you said, industry change, hours, pay, everything considered. But that's not going to happen overnight. That's going to be a very long-term thing. And the sooner that happens, the easier it will be. But we persevere.
Amazing. Gareth, thanks so much for talking. Awesome to catch
Pleasure.
Up. Can't wait to maybe one day when international travel's back to come rock up to RSA and have some dinner.
Yeah, that'd be banging.
Awesome.
Lovely to speak to you.
Mate.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Hold up. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.